Praise the Lord.
Thank you for those songs, Danny. That was great. Kind of wakes you up and gets you going. All right, let's turn to Psalm 89. I'm going to read verse 14. Psalm 89:14 says something, I think, pretty basic. Justice and judgment are the habitation of thy throne. Mercy and truth shall go before thy face. All right, I'm going to talk about justice. Of course, this mentions more than just justice. It mentions judgment and mercy and truth. Now, justice is probably not the most favorite attribute of God that we think about, because, well, we're sinners, and justice can be scary if you're a sinner, right? We think more of His mercy. We think more of His truth. We think more of His salvation, His compassion. We think of Him as being faithful and, you know, making promises and being a powerful deliverer. All of these attributes of God we might really relish to talk about more than justice, but justice is foundational. You cannot understand the mercy of God unless you understand His justice. Mercy makes no sense if there's no justice. Justice is foundational. Mercy has to come after it. So, and also I want to deal with the issue of that one of the complaints about God is that He appears to be unjust. He seems to be unjust, and you'll hear people complain about God all the time and say, it's not fair, it's not right, why does God do this to me? Why is this happening to me? Everybody wants to talk about how unfair life is, and life is unfair. Fairness, of course, is subjective, while justice is objective. Fairness is relative, while justice is absolute. And we'll get into that a little bit more. Just consider the idea that when I say justice, I don't mean fairness in the sense that everybody gets the same. Because, you know, we can talk about fairness till the cows come home. And of course, life's not fair either. And yet, it's not really the same thing. I'm not talking about fairness. I heard LeBron James make a statement to the press after his front gate was, you know, graffitied by somebody. They put on a racial slur on his front gate. And I'm not sure how he got to, whoever they did, got to his front gate, because he lives in this mansion, you know. So I'm not sure why they don't have a gated community or something. But one way or the other, somebody painted something on his front gate. And you know you don't like that, right? Somebody paints on your wall. Somebody paints on your house or your garage door or something. It's happened to me. You got to get out there and clean it up the next day. And it just bothers you. You wish you could catch the guy, right? Yeah. You want to catch him, right? Why? Because of justice. You want justice. Anyway. LeBron James says, man, it sure is tough to be a black in America. Now, you stop and think about that. This fella is rich. I mean, rich. And he probably wasn't always rich, but still, he's got it pretty good right now. And yet, he comes out with this idea that it's tough to be black in America. And obviously, it is tough for some people to be black in America. they got some rough rows to hoe. And I understand that there are some serious inequalities, and people are being treated wrong sometime. And I get tired of seeing that the police just shot somebody. You know, I get tired of that, too. Why did they have to shoot him? It didn't seem like that was necessary. We see these things all the time, and I'm not trying to get into that argument right now. I just want to point out that when you're talking about fairness, it makes a difference who you compare yourself to. You see, because it is true that blacks have it tougher in America than whites have it. That is true. But blacks have it a whole lot better in America than blacks have it in Africa. In fact, blacks in America have it better than most all groups of people that have ever lived in all of history and in all of time. Right now, in all of the world, they got it better in America. They got it better. They wouldn't trade places with any of them. And the reason why I know that is because they're free to go. They can go. They can trade places. They can go over there. So it's obviously that it's the fairness idea is subjective. It has to do with where your vantage point is. And if all you do is look and accuse God of being unfair because you're comparing yourself to somebody else, all you got to do is turn it around and compare yourself to some other person, and you might realize God's not fair. He's extremely merciful to you. Man. Now, what LeBron should have said was, I am so glad I'm an American. I am so glad God blessed me. And I feel sorry for those people who have to go around painting people's houses. And if they hate me, I'm sorry about that. You know, you could have a thankful attitude and it would be a whole lot better. It would just plain be better. The truth is, most of us will have a bad attitude once in a while because we're thinking about fairness. But fairness and justice are slightly different. Now I realize that justice has something to do with fairness, like in certain situations, like if you're playing basketball, you want the same rules to apply to both teams, right? That would be fair. You want the same rules. And if you're playing volleyball and the sun's in your face and the sun's at the back of the other team, well, that's not fair. Everybody knows that's not fair, right? Did you know UCLA did a study and found out that our sense of fairness is hardwired into our brain? It's part of our brain. It's something like the desire for food. It's in there. It's a desire for fairness. They did this, the experiments with animals, with mice and with monkeys and all that stuff. You know, it's the idea of fairness. It's in us. It's built in. We have a sense of, hey, that's not fair. How come they're getting more than me? Anyway. However, justice has to do with right and wrong. Justice has to do with our sense of morality, our sense of merit. In fact, it is a natural, rational sense that we have. Along with, I've mentioned them before, we have a rational sense called aesthetics. That is, we have the intuition of beauty. We have the natural, rational sense of empathy, which is the intuition of identity, love and hate and all that stuff. We also have a rational sense of humor. That's the intuition of irony and things like that. And they can't replicate these things in their artificial intelligence experiments. They cannot replicate humor. No computer understands humor. In fact, most humans don't understand humor. If you'll study it up, try to figure out the different theories about humor. My, you'll find out they really don't know why we laugh. They don't know. Now, comedians are really good at getting you to laugh, and they've figured out how to do it, but they don't know why it works. Why is something funny? It's really hard to figure out. And I challenge you to do that. Figure that out and explain it to me. But now I'm going to deal with two rational senses, slightly different, very similar, but slightly different. The rational sense of ethics, the intuition of duty, and the rational sense of justice, the intuition of merit. Now notice, what I'm talking about here is morality and debt and guilt and duty and merit and all these things. For example, if an animal kills an animal, do we call it murder? No, it's not murder. If a man kills an animal, do we call it murder? No, it's not murder. If an animal kills a man, do we call it murder? No, it's not murder. But if a man kills a man, do we call it murder? Right. Now notice that's the logic. You got the four results, and so you obviously have two things you got to consider here, and the reason why we consider that a man killing a man is murder is because of our sense of duty and our sense of merit. And that's why you can have four results and only one of them be apply, because it has to have both of these factors. You have to have a sense of merit and a sense of duty. The sense of duty is on the part of the person who's doing the killing. He has a duty. He has a duty to do the right thing. And the sense of merit is on the part of the person being killed. He has merit. He has rights. He has as much a right to live as you do. So we know that this idea of justice, this idea of morality, it has to do with our sense of duty and our sense of merit. And since animals have no duty, there's no moral duty in animals. A crocodile or an alligator, like that alligator that killed that little baby just recently, grabbed that little baby, pulled it in the water, and they got it later, but it was already dead. Well, they killed the animal, but not because of a sense of justice or a sense of... because the animal has no... alligators doing what alligators do. There's no sense of duty on the part of an alligator. None of us expect an alligator to understand and do the right thing. I don't know why that's funny, but I'm glad you're laughing. Any kind of feedback is good, you know. I like it. We don't expect animals to know what to do or to do the right thing, but we do expect people to. We expect people to think their actions through and then be accountable, responsible for whatever action they choose to do. That's our sense of duty. And then the sense of merit. And God explains it in this sense. He says, man was made in the image of God, so you better treat him right. And here's the reality. People have merit. People have rights. How does Thomas Jefferson say it? He says, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. He calls it self-evident. And of course, if we take that as our starting assumption, then it is self-evident. We don't have to be a scientist and try to prove that it's self-evident. The truth is, we just take that as our starting assumption. People have merits. People have a right to live. And that is why abortion is wrong. Now, I'm not saying there aren't some cases that would confuse Solomon. There are. There are some cases that would confuse Solomon, and I'm not trying to make an extended argument over all the different possibilities in abortion. What I will say is that abortion on demand for your convenience is wrong. Why? Because that baby has a right to live. Even our founding documents say that we have the right to life. And even in our Constitution, it says that we shall not be deprived of life without due process, right? That's called the right to life, and that's the argument of right to life. Now, here's the point. I'm going to make several points. That right there is more or less an introduction. I'm going to make the point that God is a God of justice. God claims to be a God of justice, and God and justice itself, in a great way, depends upon our understanding of God. And the next I'm going to say, God expects us to serve the interests of justice. God is that. The first is the principle. The second is the purpose. We have a purpose in life, and we are to serve the interests of justice. And third is that God allows injustice often. He's postponing justice in many ways, and that is very disturbing to all of us. We don't want justice to be postponed. But then there's the promise, and that is that God will apply justice eventually. And it is inevitable. Let's deal with this idea of justice. People will accuse God of being unfair, being unjust because of some trial or some trouble or because of wars or because of disease or because of cholera. Because all those years, all those people died of cholera when all they needed to do was this certain simple solution. And God could have told them that by revelation, but he didn't. He let them die of cholera. And you think of the difference between George Whitefield and John Wesley, both of them preaching up a storm, and George Whitefield dies of consumption, of tuberculosis at the age of 56 years old. And John Wesley lives till he's almost 90. That's not fair. They're both preaching. They're both trying to do the right thing. They're both doing good. And yet one dies of consumption. And all God had to do was whisper in George Whitefield's ear, this is how you solve that problem. And it would have been solved. But nope, God just says, nope, let him die of consumption. You say, well, that's not fair. And yeah, you're right. It's not fair. It's not fair. And if you're going to go around trying to make everything fair, you're going to have an awful lot of complaints against God. Right? All right. Our sense of justice is natural. It is natural. But justice makes no sense whatsoever if there is no God. Now, I know that there is, among these great philosophers of the Western tradition, people like John Stuart Mill and John Locke and Hume and Voltaire and, you know, these kind of people. Real smart people, by the way. They'll confuse you if you try to read their books. They're very smart. But anyway, and they'll bore you to tears, too. But the truth is, they had this idea that we need to come up with a justification for our sense of justice without invoking God. So that's what they're doing. They're trying. They'll come up with the social contract idea. Since we all come to an agreement, you don't kill me if I don't kill you. And since we have that agreement, if one of us breaks that agreement, well, then we've done an injustice. But there's no absolute injustice. There's nothing wrong with killing you in an absolute sense. It's just that since we both agreed, let's not kill each other, then there is such a thing as justice. They're trying to justify the existence of justice without invoking God. And the truth is, even really, really smart people can be dumb. You can't really justify the existence of justice if you do not have a God and if there is no judgment. There's no sense of morality. There's no right or wrong. There's no up or down. There's nothing. If all we are is an accident of nothingness, we're just a random production of nothing. If that's all we are, then there is no justice. It cannot exist. It's illogical to argue about it. All right, I could go deeper into that, but I'm not going to because I think it's self-evident. I like that. That's a good one. Self-evident. We'll just say we start with that assumption. Justice, the sense of justice is universal. All people have it. In fact, I think that kids know it when they're very, very, very small. And you'll know they'll say that, that's not fair. They always say, that's not fair. That's not right. Just have 10 grandkids over and give all of them a lollipop except one. And see if they don't know that something's wrong there. Anyway, look at Acts chapter 28 and verse 3. I think this is a fascinating It brings up several points that need to be made. I will not be able to get two of them today. But if you look at Acts chapter 28 and verse 3, it says, "And when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, there came a viper out of the heat and fastened on his hand. And when the barbarians saw the venomous beast hang on his hand, they said among themselves, 'No doubt this man is a murderer, whom, though he hath escaped the sea, yet vengeance suffereth not to live.'" Now, you can go on and explain the story. It's wonderful. God had given the apostles a special ability to withstand poisons. That's what he says in Mark chapter 16. What modern versions say doesn't really belong in the Bible, but it says it right there, and it was fulfilled in Acts chapter 28, verse 3. The apostles could take up snakes, and they wouldn't be hurt by them. And this happened to this apostle. He was bit by a snake, and he should have died. Anybody gets bit by that snake, it's understood you're going to die. And there's no antidote, there's no solution, there's no emergency room, there's nothing to do, you're just going to die. And so what did they come up with? What was their conclusion? He had escaped the sea. He was supposed to have drowned, but somehow, miraculously, they all made it to land. Nobody drowned. But there he is gathering sticks, and of all the bad luck, as he's gathering sticks, a viper bites him, and he should have died. But then they're watching, and he didn't die. But their first initial thought is, vengeance has not suffered him to live. Vengeance came in and made a decision. Now, what do you think they mean by vengeance? Justice. I'm going to prove that later, probably not today. But I'm going to prove that vengeance is a big part of justice. Let me tell you something. When they said vengeance, they weren't talking about, you know, some hard to define. It's everybody. Everybody knows what they're talking about. You heard it the first time he said it. You knew what they were talking about. Their sense of justice. He was a murderer, and because he was a murderer, something in the atmosphere, something in the universe said, he ain't going to live. I'm going to apply justice to him right now. Right? It's our sense of justice. Even the barbarians have that sense of justice. Even the barbarians know, you a murderer, you're going to get what's coming to you. But that's not what happens. A whole lot of murderers don't get what's coming to them. You've heard the doctrine of karma. Karma comes from Hinduism. And from Hinduism, it passes on to Buddhism and Confucianism and Taoism and who knows what else. Karma. It's the idea of cause and effect, that everything you do in this life is going to produce an effect. You're going to cause something to happen to you in the future, either in this life or in the next life. And that this is just a natural part of nature, that it just happens. Now, the real error here, first of all, is that nothing in nature causes justice to happen. Random nothingness does not produce righteousness and justness and equity and fairness. Randomness just creates randomness, and so some in a random universe, the idea of a random universe, no justice would ever be done. Justice, it would just be a coincidence if justice ever actually happened, right? It would just be a coincidence. But now these guys didn't believe in a coincidence. They said there's something that exists out there that is going to cause justice to happen. But they don't know the true God. They don't know the God of the Bible. They don't know how it's going to happen, but they know it's going to happen. How do they know it's going to happen? How do the Hindus know that something's got to happen? Because down deep inside of us, we know. We know what justice is. And none of us are satisfied when it doesn't happen. Everybody is upset when justice doesn't happen. Not just against them, but against anybody. Even you, you'll watch the news. Somebody does something and it'll get you angry. Nobody hurt you. Nobody did anything to you. But you get angry because justice wasn't done. Justice wasn't done. You hear about somebody getting off. Justice wasn't done. Bothers you. Doesn't it bother you? You know it does. It bothers you because down deep inside of you, a visceral part of you, something so deep inside of you that you had it when you were a little bitty kid, you knew that justice has to happen. Justice is greater than mankind. Justice is a greater, important principle, more great, more important than any one of our individual lives. Why? Well, because it's so much bigger than us. It's a principle. It's a principle that's deep. Goes all over the world. Everybody knows it. All of these folks, all of them know it. Now, there is such a thing called the law of the harvest, right? I think just recently, Dad preached on Galatians chapter 6, where that whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap, right? Well, isn't that karma? Isn't it karma to say that if you sow something, that you reap? Well, let me explain to you about this law of harvest. It works perfectly when there's no interference. You plant watermelons, you get watermelons, right? If you plant seeds, you're going to get a whole lot more seeds back. You reap more, right? And you reap later. All of these are part of the law of harvest. But what happens if you've got an enemy that sows corn in your field? Or tares in your field, and something happens? What happens if you have a hurricane? What happens if you have a drought? What happens if you have a disease, a blight, locusts? What happens? Then you don't get your harvest. And what does the book of Ecclesiastes say? I see people that are reaping somebody else's field. They do all of this, they gather it up, and somebody eats it. Somebody else eats it, right? That's not fair. So the law of harvest is a generic rule. It's a truism. It's a truth. But it only happens but it only works out if there's no interference. And what I see all over the world is interference. Constant interference in the reaction of justice. Constant interference in the imposition of justice. It doesn't happen. You see, because rich people who do something wrong can pay somebody off. I'm not pointing any fingers. I'm just saying that happens. It happens. I remember. In fact, I know of several cases personally. But I remember when I was in front of a magistrate, I was in front in Mexico. We had been arrested for preaching. And so they had us down there and we had to wait in line for this other people that were in front of the Ministerio Público. They had a judge there, a temporary judge in the place. And some kid had gone into some party and started shooting. And they had arrested him. And the mother of the daughter of the party was for, the mother was down there saying, this man is a menace and he's gotten away with it before. And they said, no, he'll never get away with it here. And she said, he's gotten away with it many times before because his father is a judge. Got away with it many times before. And a young man in our church in Irapuato got shot by some kid of a rich politician saw him walking around the street and took his pistol out and shot him in the back. And now he is incapable of walking. He's now confined to a wheelchair for the rest of his life. Not fair. Did that kid get in trouble? Did he go to prison? No. His dad's a politician. Got away with it scot-free. They know who it was. They've got witnesses. Can't do anything about it. Where's justice? Where's justice? It doesn't happen. Wow. All right, let me point out to you, this is the principle. God is a God of justice. Now, this is just to prove it scripturally. You might have to take it by faith for a while. God is a God of justice. Let's look. Look at Genesis chapter 18. This is one of my dad's favorite verses, mentions it constantly. I appreciate that. Sometimes you got to repeat things so it sticks.
Amen.
Doesn't count if you're amening yourself. Look at Genesis chapter 18, and we're going to read verse 25. Genesis 18, 25. This is Abraham arguing with God, and one of Abraham's arguments is, that be far from thee to do after this manner to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked, that be far from thee, shall not the judge of all the earth do right? The judge of all the earth, isn't he going to do right? Isn't that a good starting assumption? We can say we hold this truth to be self-evident. The judge of all the earth has to do right. Or what business is it of his to be a judge? We'll get into that later too, about the appropriateness or the legitimacy of judgment. So look at verse, let me see, there's another one in that chapter, verse 19. Genesis 18, verse 19 says, God is speaking now, and he's saying that he's going to tell Abraham what he's going to do. So he says, for I know him, I know Abraham, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him. What is the way of the Lord? Justice and judgment. That's the way of the Lord. Why? Isn't that something? Look at Deuteronomy. I'm getting these a little bit out of order, but who cares? Look at Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 4. You'll get the gist. Deuteronomy 32, verse 4 says, he is the rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are judgment. A God of truth and without iniquity. Just and right is he. What does the Bible tell us about our God? He's just. He is righteous. He does the right thing. Not just by because he's forced to, because he'll lose the next election if he doesn't. Now, there are some judges that do the right thing because they'll lose the next election if they don't. And there are some judges that do the right thing because that widow woman just keeps knocking on his door at 6 o'clock in the morning. So they'll do the right thing under those circumstances. But not our God. That's his way. That's his nature. That's how he is. Look at Nehemiah chapter 9, verse 33. It says, howbeit thou art just in all that is brought upon us, for thou hast done right, but we have done wickedly. Yeah, you're getting it, right? You're seeing this. God is just. Everybody recognizes it. Look at Psalm 98, verse 9. Well, that's a really good verse, but it doesn't include the context, so let's read a little bit earlier. I said Psalm 98, and I'm not there yet. Verse 9, let's read before. Let the hills be joyful together before the Lord, for he cometh to judge the earth. With righteousness shall he judge the world, and the people with equity. Look at, let's get some of these. Look at Isaiah chapter 9 and verse 7. Some of you guys could just quote that. Isaiah 9, 7. That's where, you know, it's talking about the son is born. The child is given. Let's see here. It says 9 verse 7. There it is. Of the increase of his government and peace there shall be no end, upon the throne of David and upon his kingdom, to order it and to establish it with judgment and with justice from henceforth even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. Not only is it natural for him, not only is it his way of doing things, not only is it a promise that he's given us that he's going to take care of this, but it even says he's going to do it with zeal. Zeal! Boy, don't you wish you could get some zeal out of some judges? Some zeal out of some policemen. Some zeal out of parents. To do right. To do the right thing. How about some zeal out of your employees? Boy, that would be nice. Well, God is going to do it with zeal. Oh, let's see. There's plenty more. Plenty more. Not necessary to hit them all. Look at Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 23. I said 31:23 of Jeremiah. It says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, as yet they shall use this speech in the land of Judah and in the cities thereof, when I shall bring again their captivity. The Lord bless thee, O habitation of justice and mountain of holiness." It's a promise about the nation of Israel that sooner or later they're going to start using that kind of speech about their land. It's going to be the habitation of justice. Isn't that what we read in Psalm 89 at the first? We started off reading that. It said, justice and judgment are the habitation of thy throne. All right. Our God is a God of justice. It's his nature. It's his way. It's his decision, his will, his judgments that he makes. It's his delight. And it's his focus. And it's his focus. All right. I'm not going to go into that anymore because now I'm going to get to the second section of what I want to deal with. Not only that it is a principle, that God is a God of justice, and that this principle is real in us, and that we understand it, and we would not respect our God, we could not respect our God if he was not just. Because we understand justice. How do you understand justice, by the way? It's not something that, you know, I know that parents don't go around to their kids teaching them all about justice when they're very small. They just seem to pick it up. They just seem to grasp it. How is it that you can discern colors? How do you know the difference between green and blue? How do you know? Well, it's in you. It's down in there. It's down in there. God put it in you. How is it that you know what's funny? It's in you. Some God put it down in there. How is it that you understand you can get the feelings out of music? There's nothing in music that should cause these things. Not automatically, but God has put receptors in you. How he's done it, I don't know, but you got the receptors. I got news for you. He gave you the receptors of justice. You got the ability to discern it. You have the ability to recognize justice when it happens and to recognize injustice when it doesn't happen. And if God were not just, you could not possibly respect him. If God were an evil mean, if he were cruel, if he delighted in hurting people, if he were just destructive rather than so incredibly creative, if he was some other kind, if God were like the devil, you couldn't respect him even if you knew he was all powerful and he had your life in his hands. You would not be able to respect him. In fact, I suspect that you would shake your fist at him and feel perfectly justified in doing it. If we can distinguish between right and wrong, then that gives us some direction in life. It should make us aim a certain way, right? Now, for some reason why, we humans tend to go the wrong way. I think it has to do with original sin. I think that we have some evil inclination within us that causes us to desire or to want the wrong. To disagree or dislike God. But There is something in us also that makes us clearly recognize the difference between right and wrong, and it gives us a sense of direction. It gives us a sense of purpose, a way to aim ourselves. And we aim our children that way, and we try to build our communities that way. We try to build our business that way. How long would a business stay in business if all of their clients they stole from? They wouldn't stay in business long. Everybody knows that it's much better to do things the right way. Justice. Now, that God expects us to serve the interests of justice, that God is expecting you to be a certain way. Let's see if that's true. In fact, before I go to that, I don't have enough time. God does expect us to do that. Oh, let's see, where did I do it? Look at Proverbs chapter 11, verse 1. This is an interesting... Yes, that God expects us to serve the interest of justice. I said verse 1 of 11. How does God say this? A false balance is abomination to the Lord, but a just weight is His delight. Remember, He delights in justice. Now, He says a false balance is an abomination to the Lord. What's a false balance? It's like you're at the market, and they would have a balance there, and they would have a weight. And this weight is supposedly 1 pound. They used other stuff, but they should have used pounds. It's a lot easier for me. The pound there, and then so they weigh out the wheat or the corn or the grain or something else on this other side of the balance. And when it balances out, they say, there you are. There's your pound of corn, whatever. But if you have a weight there that's not quite a pound, what happens? You're giving them less wheat. And what God says is a false weight is an abomination to God. Well, that makes sense, right? It's an abomination to you, too, especially if they're taking your money, if they're cheating you. Look how many times this is mentioned right there in Proverbs. Look at chapter 16, verse 11. It's real, real simple that he just mentions it over and over and over again. And I'm not even touching a minor fraction of how many times this is mentioned. A just weight and balance are the Lord's. All the weights of the bag are His work. In other words, if you get it exactly right, not too heavy, not too light, you get it exactly right, God says, that's my work. You see, God is zealous. God is zealous about justice. That's why you ought to be a little more zealous about, you know, the time you take in work. You ought to be a little more zealous about how you sell your used vehicles. Right? Yeah. You ought to be a little more zealous about paying your bills on time. Didn't even get one amen out of that one. Anyway. So we're not terribly zealous about, you know, they say, let's not get overworked. Don't be over much righteous. Don't be over much righteous. Wag your finger at us. Come on. But God says, that's mine. That's mine. I love that. That's what I love. Somebody went to a lot of trouble to get that weight exactly right and won't let anybody mess with it. Oh, boy, I like that one. Look at chapter 20, verse 10. That's in Proverbs, chapter 20, verse 10. Divers weights, that's diverse, that means different. Divers weights and divers measures, both of them are alike abomination to the Lord. Now, what is he saying here? Different. Different. You got two different weights in your bag. What are you doing with two different weights? You say, well, I only use the good one. What are you doing with the one that's not right? What are you doing with counterfeit bills? What are you doing with that? That you shouldn't be having that. Look at chapter, same chapter, look at verse 23. Divers weights are an abomination unto the Lord, and a false balance is not good. Wow, look at Leviticus chapter 19, verse 35. There are a number of really good verses in Leviticus, right, Danny? Really good verses in Leviticus. In fact, the most quoted verse in the New Testament comes out of Leviticus. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, in case you were wondering. Anyway, look at Leviticus, I said, chapter 19 and verse 35. Ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meat yard, that's measurement, in weight, or in measure. Actually, now, since it says measure there, I don't know what meat yard is. I have to look that one up. Just balances, just weights, a just ephah, that's a volume measurement, and a just hin, I think that's a liquid measurement, shall ye have. I'm the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. You're going to do it my way. We're going to have everything exactly perfect and right. No skimping, no shaving, no sliding, no slippery, no nothing. Everything absolutely perfectly right. Exactly the truth. Exactly the weight. How is it about this? This is God. He's saying, I'm extremely zealous about this. I want it done. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verse 13. God is a God of justice. Don't forget it. This is not his greatest attribute. Mercy rejoices against judgment. We get it. We understand it. But let's lay the foundation. God is a God of justice. Deuteronomy 25, I said verse 13. Thou shalt not have in thy bag divers weights, a great and a small. You see? In the same bag, you got two different weights. One's bigger, one's smaller. He said, you better not have that. Thou shalt not have in thine house divers measures, a great and a small. Not even in your house. Not even as an adornment on your wall. Nope. Do not have it. All right. There's plenty more to deal with that on. This is just my point that I'm trying to make here is that God expects us to serve the interests of justice. This is something that he's looking at us at and saying, I want you to be like this, because if you're not like this, it displeases me. And he's extremely zealous about this. So he expects us to serve the sense of justice, the interests of justice. Now, he also goes to a lot of trouble to set us up in implementing institutional justice. Remember over there in Genesis chapter 9, after the flood was over and they all come out of the ark? They all come out of the ark and they're standing on dry land, and God says, I'm going to change some things. Because before the flood, there was no institutional justice. There was no authority for anybody to apply rules of justice. And so that's why the earth was filled with violence. Nobody was getting in trouble for the bad things that they did. Everybody was just doing whatever was right in their own eyes. That's why road rage happens, by the way. Road rage happens because nobody's getting caught. They're doing horrible things and nobody gets caught. And after three or four people do you wrong on the road and you have a tendency to be enraged, well, then that last person that did you wrong on the road is going to get it. That's what happens. They'll chase them down and they'll shoot them. It's because no justice. They're getting away with it. And you know how that feels. That's horrible. You hate it. It's something inside you. You hate it. Well, God said after the flood, he said, we're going to change some things. And he says, now anybody who slays somebody else, by man shall his blood be spilt. God delegated the authority to people to institute justice among themselves. That's a huge step that God made right there. It's a step that actually is the foundation for all of our justice systems, all of our government. We can base all government on that statement by God. I've changed some things. Now you're responsible to impose or to institutionalize justice. I got a few minutes. I'm just going to give you an idea about this. What is the purpose of a justice system? This is just from our studies in the justice system. I didn't study law, but I have to learn some things about law, because if I don't understand it, I can't interpret it. So I'm forced to study up on some things. And what I've noticed is that we get a little bit confused about what the justice system is about. The purpose of our justice system is this, supposedly. It's punitive, even though nowadays with juveniles, they don't think of it as punitive. They don't want to punish the juveniles. They have other reasons. Okay, it's punitive means retributive, retaliatory, or vindictive. That's where vengeance comes in. Somebody needs to pay. Somebody, you hurt me, you ought to be hurt. That seems right. You ought to be punished. It's protective. That is, it's supposed to incapacitate or limit the power to reoffend. So it is protective. It's trying to keep somebody from doing the same thing again. And that's where you get over there in the Sharia law, where if somebody steals, they cut off their hand, right? Well, there you go. That'll take care of that. It's deterrent. Cutting off the hand is not a deterrence. Well, it may be, actually. But cutting the hand off is actually incapacitating the person to commit the crime again. Here in the West, we just put them in prison. Which, you know, some people say that cutting off the hand is cruel. You could also say putting somebody in prison is kind of cruel. So, anyway. It's also a deterrent. The punishment, the justice system, is not just punitive and protective, it's also trying to diminish the willingness to reoffend, make people afraid to do it. And that's why they're very careful to put harsher and harsher punishments on harsher and harsher crimes, so that it could be a deterrent. And that is why you'll have the argument that, you know, you need to have something really, in fact, every single voting cycle, every single election cycle, you'll have somebody on there saying, we need to be harder on criminals. Somebody asked me, what do we do to stop these kids from tagging? I said, shoot them. Somebody says, amen. Amen, shoot them. No. We got to be careful now. No, but that's about the only way to stop them. But if you increase the punishment, and they have done it, by the way, folks, they have made tagging, if it costs a certain amount of money, a felony. A felony. It's a felony right here in this state, in this county. It's a felony to tag if it does a certain amount of damage. And boy, there's just no way in the world to equate, you know, tagging, which is pretty bad. I agree. It's rotten. But it's not the same thing as shooting up a house or something like that, right? It doesn't seem to me. Anyway, the fourth is not just deterrence. It's also rehabilitative. Or the Bible might call it redemptive. It's the idea of improving the character of somebody. It's giving offenders the opportunity to resolve their guilt, to get back into society and be clean, be paid, have it paid off. It's the idea of rehabilitative. Give somebody another chance. And by the way, parents, when you're spanking your kids, make sure they have a way of having it done and over with. Finished. It's done. You're not going to hold that against them anymore. Why? They paid for it. Get it behind them. That's the idea of rehabilitative. Restitutive. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. Reparative, compensative, restorative. In other words, if somebody got stolen from, they ought to get that money back. And they get it all the time. We have the idea of restitution so much. I had this one kid. They started a fire in a house that had just been built. Started a fire, burned the house down. They hadn't put insurance on it. The entire loss, over $300,000. His restitution was, joint and several with a couple of other kids, $300,000. When's he ever going to pay that back? Still, we all agree in the sense of justice, he ought to be paid back. And even if he had insurance, the insurance company ought to be paid back, seems to me. All right, restitutive. If they don't get paid back, then it's not really justice. Come on, you know it. And the sixth is denunciative, instructive to others. Abstract justice is worthy in itself. And I consider this really to be just the fear of God. Justice itself deserves to be observed, even if there's no other benefit involved. Somebody ought to be proclaimed clearly. For example, it ought to be illegal to have an abortion for your convenience. It ought to be illegal. Somebody says, yeah, but even if we make it illegal, they'll still do it. It still ought to be illegal. Why? For the denunciative reason. So that it can be said clearly, this is wrong. I've run out of time. We'll start up next week or sometime.